This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's been a busy week in Raleigh at the legislature, and yet there is still no budget. We're nearly 2 months into the fiscal year, and lawmakers are on their third extension, I believe. Could be their second. About to be their third. But we get an update on that and what else has been going on later in the program. First, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Chief Kerr Putney is back with us. Today marks exactly a week since the Randall Carrick mistrial. Protests over the decision were few, arrests fewer, but Chief Putney believes there is a lot of work to be done in continuing to strengthen police-community relations, and he has some repair work to do within the department as well. But he joins us for the first part of the program. Welcome back.
Morning, Mike.
Good to see you. One of the things that came out of the aftermath of the Carrick mistrials were tensions within the police department over how the department handled the case at the top, particularly over how quickly the department decided to charge Officer Carrick. According to the Observer yesterday, investigations into officer-involved shootings and the use of force can take weeks or months, but CMPD arrested Carrick less than a day after he shot Farrell. You didn't make that decision. Your predecessor, Chief Monroe, did. But do you understand why?
Do I understand why it was made
so quickly?
Well, I think the main reason is because probable cause is probable cause, and that's our standard. And once that was achieved, the decision was made to make the arrest.
But Claire Fallon, City Councilmember Claire Fallon, says she's heard from officers about how the case unfolded, and she said that the department leaders failed to conduct a complete investigation before arresting Carrick. She says the process wasn't followed. Do you disagree with that?
I don't know what that process might be to which she's referring. Our process is the investigation, which led us to probable cause. I do think, though, that the speed at which that decision was made had everybody reeling, myself included.
Mm-hmm.
I was over investigations. We had detectives who were working around the clock. So I think the whole rush to judgment really is talking about the speed at which it was made. Nobody really had an opportunity to wrap their head around what all was going on.
Well, that's why I'm getting at why, because if these investigations usually take weeks or months, this took less than 24 hours, I think, or just about 24 hours. I mean, and this is before a lot of the police on African-American shootings had taken place around America. So why? What was the rush?
I don't know that there was a rush, Mike. I think when PC was established, the decision was made. We had a lot of conversations around it. We knew what we were dealing with. It was just a matter of making the arrest because probable cause had been achieved.
And you've called this, I believe, a painful but necessary decision reached by people both within CMPD and in consultation with the district attorney's office. And yet it took two grand juries to finalize charges against Randall Carrick. Was the arrest necessary so that there could be due process, or were there pressures to act?
There was no pressure that I'm aware of. And I can tell you the arrest had to be made because probable cause was established.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the community's torn, and there's no doubt that the grand juries, it took two. I'm aware of that, too. One, the first one was not a full panel. The second was that came back with a true bill. And as you can see, Charlotte is divided, and so is the jury mm-hmm. through their deliberations. Our organization is divided as well. It's time to start healing.
Randy Hagler, who's the president of the North Carolina Fraternal Order of Police, says that is where hard feelings come from.
I totally agree.
I'm going to play what he said, and then we can talk about it.
All right,
go ahead.
There was so much left to be done, but they charged him right away, and that's what's left of a sore spot in a lot of our officers' opinion.
So he's referring to the fact that there seems to be a lot of disgruntlement within the department among officers about how this was handled, and they almost feel like they were thrown under the bus.
Absolutely. I've heard that loud and clear, that they feel Carrick was thrown under the bus, so to speak. And what I can tell you is we've had a lot of conversations, still continuing those open lines of communication so that I can hear, fully appreciate, and understand. I tell everybody, they say, what would I do differently? My approach is a little different. I am more methodical. Try to give myself an opportunity to, you know, wrap my head around exactly what's going on with something of this significance and be a little bit more thoughtful and deliberate in how I approach it. However, probable cause is probable cause, and the outcomes would be the same.
So you understand why your fellow officers might feel this way, but you don't necessarily agree that those feelings are justified?
I'm not saying that. I think everybody's feelings, whatever they might be, are justified. I think they are entitled to opinions, too. We all are. I have my own personal opinions, but what I can tell you is I have a deeper appreciation. Hindsight's 20/20.
Sure.
I can't turn back the clock for 2 years, but I can learn from everything that happens and be better prepared in the future and make better decisions in the future as we move forward. I think probable cause is still going to be probable cause, and arrests will have to be made if laws are broken, obviously. But the time and the thoughtfulness, I think I will be a bit more I have a great deal more insight as it relates to that moving forward.
One of the things that has upset many people in the rank and file at CMPD was the fact that they were told that the dash cam video would show certain things, and it ended up when they showed it during the trial that it did not provide clear and convincing evidence that Carrick had committed a crime. And they felt that management at the time had not been truthful to them, the officers. What do you say about that?
I've heard that, too. I've heard a lot of things, Mike, and I don't know who all was saying these things. I didn't really have a lot of opportunity to talk about it. I was processing. This was a punch to the gut for all of us. It was a hard situation, and I understand a lot of hard feelings, but I don't know. There are a lot of things that people are recalling they heard. I just don't know from whom they heard them. And I can understand the frustration, though. Whenever you're an officer on the front line and you feel management's failing you,
yeah.
you're gonna have some hard feelings, and that's reasonable.
You know better than I, but what I read was that they heard it from commanders within the force.
Sure.
Stick with us because the video will show what it needs to show. Did you see the video?
I did.
Prior to the trial?
Yes.
And what did you take away from having seen the video?
Well, I'm not going to get too deep into it. It's still ongoing. I can just tell you, in my gut, I felt people would make up their own minds and have their own preconceived notions. And to be quite frank with you, I don't know that the video would change those. That's kind of my takeaway from it.
But if officers were told that this would present clear and convincing evidence, do you see it that way? Did it present clear and convincing evidence? Because the jury evidently didn't see it that way.
In my opinion, no. I just think it shows clearly that Farrell's hands didn't have a weapon in them. That was obvious. Mm-hmm. And he was running in the direction of the camera. So all I can deal with is facts. I'm not trying to interpret what people are thinking or anything else. And so what I could see clearly is the man was unarmed.
The city decided to pay $2.25 million to Jonathan Farrell's family to settle a civil suit before the criminal trial even began. Is that the way things are usually handled?
That's a good question. I think it's not a question for me, but my understanding of it is it was a business decision.
Does that play into why some of the police officers feel that this was not handled well?
I believe it plays into why not just the police, but quite a few members of the community at large have those feelings. But what I can tell you is they're separate and apart. Just like a civil suit, the threshold is different. It's preponderance of evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the threshold for a criminal case.
And yet we hear that because this all took place so rapidly, the charging of Officer Carrick, the fact that the dash cam video did not show what they were allegedly told it would show, and the fact that the city paid $2.25 million to Farrell's family before the trial started, and because Officer Carrick is not being reimbursed for his legal expenses, we've heard that a lot of police officers are now saying, well, I'm just not going to get involved in certain things. I'm not going to volunteer for certain calls, and I'm going to they're not backing me up, so I'm just not going to do what I need to do.
I've heard that, and my conversation with them is simple. I'm not asking you to give me your trust. I'm asking you to give me opportunity to earn it. And along those lines, what I can tell you, too, is I hear a lot of that, and I know that is out of frustration, but what I've seen is heroes who step up when there's a robbery spree, three robbers going around with a laser on their firearm, robbing people, and our heroes find that car, give chase, and apprehend those suspects. So I hear what they're saying, and it's an emotional response, but I also know their hearts, and I also know what they were sworn to do, and they're still doing it. Mm-hmm. So I get it. I want them to vent. I want them to get that out. I want to understand those feelings so that we can heal as an organization, but I also see heroic work being done that is counter to that that concept.
Do you know of any instances where people, where police officers have kind of pulled punches, but because they don't want to get themselves into a situation that they may regret doing?
I do not, Mike. Do I doubt that they feel under siege? Absolutely not. I know they feel that way. They're not the only officers that feel that way. Everybody across the country in this line of work who's on the front lines has that perception.
Why?
Mainly because they don't get to see a lot of the conversations and hear what people are saying. The vast majority of people still support their law enforcement officers. However, there's a local element, a vocal element, I should say, that drowns that out, and it makes them feel that they aren't appreciated and that they are under siege.
Well, there is a certain segment of the population who have seen all of these shootings around the country by police officers of African-American males particularly, and are appalled by how quickly it happened and how unjustified some of these shootings apparently have been. They see it one way. Do the people within the force see it another? Because you are the people out there on the front lines. You are the people who are risking your lives. Do you see it a different way?
Well, I represent the people. I'm not.
I understand that.
Sure. But that matters. Those semantics matter. I respect what they do, Mike. They do it, and I don't. They do it in a time that I haven't had to. So I have to respect and appreciate that. But I can tell you, internally, we're as divided as we are as a city and as a country, especially around race. As we see situations, what I can tell you is officers are intelligent enough, though, to know the difference. The North Charleston incident is a lot different from anything we've experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are clearer lines there. But the case we're talking about, or the case that is going through the courts, is a bit more complicated than that one. It's not quite as clear cut. So our officers can discern that. But again, all in all, when you hear white officers shooting black unarmed people, they do feel unappreciated and sometimes under siege because of the environment that creates.
Chief, your predecessor, Rodney Monroe, at least to most of us, his departure, his announced retirement, seemed relatively quick, and it happened just weeks before the Randall Carrick trial started. He's the one that brought charges. Do you think that has anything to do with his decision to retire?
No.
That he didn't want to be in the job when this trial verdict came down?
I don't believe that at all, no. My knowledge of him is that's not how he operates. And also, the decision was not just his to make. Everybody, the chief gets credit and blame for everything. I'm learning that quickly, obviously, as I quote-unquote transition. But what I can tell you is it was a bit more deliberate than that. Other people weighed in, including our prosecution here locally, and that's how that decision was made.
In the wake of this, police training has come into question. There was a question over when it's appropriate or allowable for an officer to draw their weapon and prepare to use, or in fact to use, lethal force. What is department policy?
Department policy, Mike, is actually pretty clear. The problem is the dynamics of an incident are a bit more complex than that. But at the end of the day, you have to have a reasonable belief that your life is in jeopardy. You're going to lose your life or suffer severe injuries as a result of the encounter. You can't anticipate. You just have to be in a position where you're about to lose your life is basically the threshold.
And I want to come back particularly to the Randall Carrick situation after the break, because he pulled his revolver after another officer pulled and used a taser. And I want to get department policy on that as well. Chief Kerr Putney is with us. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring the Big Bow Box for tailgating, including chicken, biscuits, fixins, and freshly steeped iced tea, available all day at area Bojangles. Well, there have always been bullies intimidating people of all ages, but the digital age has added new platforms for bullying, and often the victims see no other way out than to choose suicide. And that is the choice that college freshman Tyler Clementi made a couple of years ago, and now his mother is working to educate people around the country about the problem. She'll be in Charlotte Monday for events surrounding the Stand Up, Sing Out concert to stop bullying, and Jane Clementi will join us Monday morning at 9. Thank you.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The shooting of two journalists in Virginia renews calls for gun control. President Obama visits New Orleans to mark the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And the U.S. stock market takes investors on a wild ride.
The news roundup on the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Police Chief Kerr Putney from Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police. Getting back to police training, because that did come up during the Carrick trial, and just trying to get the rules sorted out. And these things have to be made in split-second moments of life-or-death decisions. There was some question about whether or not Officer Carrick should have drawn his weapon, not a pistol, not his revolver, but a pistol, after another officer had pulled or used a taser. Is that the way it goes? Is that how it should happen? If there are two or three officers on the scene, does the taser go first, and then if he pulls the taser, you use another weapon?
And I'm trying to be delicate here, Mike. I can't talk to the specifics of the case, obviously, because it's yet to be determined, but what I can tell you is our policy states, and it's pretty clear, you can draw your weapon for lethal cover mm-hmm. when you suspect that a suspect might be armed. So if I suspect you may be armed, I can draw my weapon with or without somebody having a taser there. So that's an independent decision that is within policy.
We had three officers on the scene of that incident. One drew no weapons, one drew a taser, one drew a pistol.
Yes, sir.
Is that the normal state of affairs? Is that how it works? Or is that up to the individual officer?
It is. It's an individual decision. So what we do encourage, though, is if you suspect that this person may be armed, someone should have lethal cover, obviously. Given the situation, if all three officers are in that position, initially they all three can draw their weapon, but then from there we teach the transition so there's some less lethal options as well.
You have said that the trial revealed differing interpretations within the department over the use of deadly force, and that more training will obviously have to be applied or given so that people apply these things in the same way. What's your plan for that?
Well, two things. One is this is bigger than this trial, so just in the assessment overall, Mike, we see that there might be some disconnect. And I also appreciate the fact that you actually did quote me. I think it is a matter of interpretation sometimes. However, I don't even want gaps in how we interpret. I want us to do so many reps, just like the CEU officers did. I want to do so many reps that it becomes second nature, that you know the nuances of when you should be at lethal cover, when you're justified in lethal force, and when you should be looking to de-escalate, which is what we also preach. So we're going to do reps because I want it to become second nature to our people. And it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of repetitions to do it, but I think our training staff is up to that challenge.
And you also, I think, are in the paper this morning, and I'm going to use the wrong words here, but talking about the need for more situational training, where you put officers in certain situations and you watch them respond in real time.
Yes, we've increased that over the years, and I have a background in training. I have a passion for it, and I've seen the difference in how we can have people retain information just by putting them in real life situations, and then giving them that critique about the nuances of how they make moves and how they react to things, and also talking about the clear line of delineation of when they can use a certain level of force. So that gives us an opportunity to be more realistic in how we deliver our training and then how it's applied on the street.
We asked our listeners if they wanted to ask you some questions on the social media, and we've gotten a few. We'll get to as many of these as we can. Mark in Charlotte writes, please ask the chief if policies and training, which Randall Carrick was found to have been innocent of violating, will be changed, or are we to understand that going forward, black men need to understand that if they intimidate white police officers, they run the risk of being killed, even if they are unarmed?
Yeah, okay. well, the law doesn't allow for intimidation to be a part of the use of lethal force, first of all. And as I said before, I'm always going to look to analyze and assess our training, regardless of what's going on. When this is no longer a topic, we're still going to continue to do so. Not only that, I have an internal advisory council who's going through and assessing our policies and procedures as well to give me a feel from the street. These are officers, mostly officers from our patrol division who are doing this work every day, giving me insight, because I'm not doing it to that level. And also I have an external advisory committee of community leaders who are looking at our training, recruiting, internal affairs processes, and everything else to give me a broader perspective. I want to be a bit more thoughtful as we make changes to improve this organization. And yes, that is a part of how we're going to move forward.
Randy Hagler, the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, predicted that your efforts to reach out to officers to kind of salve this over will be unproductive unless you are willing to apologize for how Randall Carrick's case was investigated. Are you willing to do that, or do you think that it's necessary to do that?
Randy's a friend of mine. Uh-huh. And like I said about my CMPD family, we can all have a difference of opinion. I own everything I did and do moving forward. I'm not going to apologize for something that I don't think is wrong. We made an arrest that I believe was correct, so why would I apologize for that? Mm-hmm. I respect his opinion, and our opinions differ there.
How big a challenge do you think you had ahead of you in terms of rebuilding trust among the members of the department?
Building trust is not easy, internally or externally. But I'm confident that the way we're going to go about this deliberately and thoughtfully, mm-hmm. we're going to achieve our mission.
The protest that followed the mistrial were not there. There weren't that many. For the most part, they were peaceful. There were only three arrests, and there were many situations where your department almost appeared to be taking a hands-off approach. You were there; your presence was known. You let the protesters walk down the middle of the street. Sometimes they were touching automobiles that were in the traffic flow, and yet they didn't provoke any incidents, and they stayed out of the way. Is that why these protests were relatively peaceful and there were so few arrests?
I think it's a few reasons. I think our plan and how we operated is one. I think the other thing is the just the way we are as a city here in Charlotte. What people don't give a lot of credit to are the community members who are putting themselves in harm's way to help de-escalate the situation. And also our mere presence is a show of force, and we realize that. And so we were intentional and strategic about how we did that. We wanted people to know when you start violating the law and being aggressive towards our officers, we're going to escalate our force. And when that the idea leaves your mind and you decide to do otherwise, we can de-escalate. That's part of our plan, and that's how we move forward to make this a successful
process. Did that come out of the preparation and the execution of the preparation that went into the Democratic National Convention? Because there were no problems during that either, and yet the police from this department and other departments around the country were out in force during that convention.
That was the foundation for it. However, our move to actually escalate was different. This time we were the target. Our officers, the heroic work they were doing, they were the target this time. In the DNC, we were not. People just wanted to get their message out, and we could facilitate it. So we initially started that way with the demonstrators. But as the agitators replaced demonstrators, our tactic had to change as well.
Okay. You when you were on this program, just after you were sworn in, we talked a little bit about community police relations, and you say that there's still a lot of work to be done to build better relationships between the community and the police. You've been out there working on it a bit, and let me let you hear
sure.
what one of the protesters outside BB&T Ballpark said last Friday night
yes, sir.
During those protests.
But they're protecting this game. They're protecting this place. They're protecting this place that they feel like it's costing money for this city. But anything else, they're not protecting it. You won't go to the west side of Charlotte right now and see these bicycle officers blocking off anything. But they're blocking off this area right here because that's where the money is created. That's where they're going to stop, and they're going to create that type of thing. And that's what we're dealing with. We're dealing with trouble, and we're dealing with a lot of things that black people have a lot of trouble with. It's not just blacks, whites, Hispanics, Asians, everybody.
What's your reaction to that?
From what I could hear, we were protecting the ballpark, and we don't protect other segments of the city similarly. And what I can tell you is I appreciate that person's opinion as well. I have a different opinion. Basically, we don't have to prepare for the aggressive agitators that showed up and replaced the protesters everywhere, but we're ready for it. They happen to come uptown, and so that's what we're gonna have to employ that. However, our ability to police this entire city is something that I think we've done well And we will continue to do well regardless of what area you might find issues.
Well, let me flip that coin over because as he was saying that you're only protecting the center city because that's where the money is. Michael on Facebook writes, last night in the Starmount neighborhood, the Westover Police Division, at least 10 police cars, the police helicopter, fire truck, and an ambulance arrived to the scene of a fight outside a home on Sherburne Drive. Five or six police drew their weapons. The police helicopter was circling around with a spotlight to arrest one man. One neighbor called the police and was told that this was a nonviolent situation and that it was taken care of. Was the amount of men and resources spent on this one arrest justified in your mind? How can we improve police-community relations when the police appear to be abusing their power and wasting taxpayer resources to arrest one man?
I don't think you're flipping the coin at all, Mike. I think what you see is we're going to use the appropriate resources wherever the situation dictates us to go, and that's what we did. What people aren't talking about is how was that resolved? There wasn't a shooting, and the officers have performed and did their job extremely well, in my opinion. The amount of resources is not determined by the police, unfortunately. It's determined by the people who are committing crimes and misbehaving. So our reaction to that, I think, is absolutely appropriate, and I stand behind those officers 110%.
You have been encouraging and fellow officers, and you've been doing this yourself, to make concerted efforts to engage with the community.
Yes,
you were out doing things last weekend out of uniform for the community. What are you encouraging officers to do?
I'm leading by example, but I tell you what I'm doing. What I'm also seeing is I'm being pleasantly surprised that they're doing it to a level that I never would have expected. We've been doing this for a while, and our goal is to connect with people on the human level so that I think we can make not only our officers but our community safer as well, because what I'm seeing is we're gaining a lot of capital and a lot of trust by doing the work and being seen as humans, not as law enforcement robots.
We know that police officers around the country do this with kids, little kids, handing out candy and bicycles and things like that. They do it with elderly people. Does it work effectively with the people who are committing the crimes? In other words, if we have a gang problem or if we have a problem with teenagers who are just getting into trouble because they got nothing else to do and they have very few role models, do you find it to be effective to interact with them on a one-on-one level?
I do. I think it's effective. But here's the other thing. I mean, some people who are going to be career criminals, it's much harder for us to engage because they don't want to engage with us. But I can tell you, too, we have people who are former prison inmates who come out and turn their lives around. And just to be quite honest with you, some of whom are partners in everything we're trying to do to make the city safer and a better place for us to work, live, and play.
Some crime statistics came out, I believe it was this week, saying that in the first half of 2015, crime was up 5.6% compared to the same period last year. In the first 3 months of this year, violent crime was up 21%. How do you read those figures? Do you understand why those things may be true?
Yes, it's a couple of reasons. One is a natural regression to the mean. I mean, we've been reducing crime. We've been trending down for the last decade, and we're fighting our own success. The other thing, though, is we're looking at specific trends that are concerning. Latino victimization and the burglary rate increase that really have us concerned. And we're doing a lot of work in those areas because we're looking now to try to stabilize and maintain a level of success that we've had. So we're looking at the areas in which we spike.
Well, one analysis that I read was that you look at those figures and you see that the number of crimes has increased, but the population has increased. So crime rate per 100,000 people is actually down.
Yes, what we've seen is, especially when you look at three-year trends, we're down about 1.3%. And what we never get to account for is that growth. We haven't grown since 2009, and this community has been explosively growing.
Jonathan on Twitter writes, how have recent events nationwide affected the way you hire and recruit? Are applications up or are they down?
It depends. It varies. For the most part, it's remained relatively steady. Mm-hmm. But the changes in recruitment are nuanced. What we're trying to do is have a lot more conversations about what's going on so people know exactly what they're facing, making sure they're the ideal people to come into this community, a very diverse community, and do the work that the public expects of them.
What attracts people to law enforcement? What kinds of people are attracted to law enforcement?
When I came on, seems like forever ago in the early 90s, it was we wanted to help people, we said. What we're hearing now is people really want to make a difference in the lives of others, and they're committing to something greater than themselves. I used to sit on the behaviorals when I was in administration as a deputy chief, and I was always blown away by how thoughtful and intentional some of these young kids are, and I call them young kids. They're in their early 20s and early to mid-20s who really want to come in and make a difference. They want to leave this community better than they found it, and I think that's kind of different. We were more about helping people on a broader sense. They're being a bit more specific and intentional about their efforts.
How many of these young people coming into law enforcement have had military training, and do you think that some of the equipment that has come to police departments here and around the country that are more reminiscent of the military has inflamed tensions between police and citizens?
Don't have the most up-to-date information on that. It's relatively flat. We haven't seen a huge increase in the number of former military people. But as far as the equipment, we're very thoughtful about how we acquire equipment and what equipment we get. And when people start using assault rifles on our officers, we won't need armored personnel carriers. It's just that simple, Mike.
Cameron on Twitter writes, thank you for the body cams, but what is CMP doing to ensure citizen access to the video?
Our issue is, and we keep talking about this, our issue is the personnel laws. It is part of your internal affairs record. I actually, initially when we're recording, except for evidentiary value, and all of that is a part of a criminal case that can't be released. However, what we are able to do is for specific complaints, we can allow for an exception where we can review it with the complainant to show whether or not that allegation is or is not baseless. But for the most part, we have North Carolina law that prevents us from just, on the whole, releasing all of that information.
Melissa, on Twitter, is there a plan to implement cultural education into the police academy to aid understanding and reduce profiling?
It's already there. We started that, I think, about 3 years ago. And right now, I've intensified those efforts with our command level, our lieutenants. We're in our second cohort this year of having them go through a year-long leadership development course, which is based in cultural competence.
We were never able to get your predecessor on this program. You took office in the middle of July. You've already been on this program twice. And you're doing kind of a media blitz this week. I think you did a lot of interviews yesterday about this situation.
Not by choice, Mike.
is this part of the department's effort to build community relations, just your being available to us?
What I can tell you is I lead by example. I'm pushing my people to get out and really own our messaging and write our own narrative for a change. And to do that and to have people do it, I got to do it myself. So, yes, it is intentional.
In your mind, should we retry Randall Carrick?
In my mind, I'm leaving that up to the people who are in control of it, which would be the North Carolina General Attorney's Office.
In 10 seconds or less, would you rehire Randall Carrick?
Again, I'm going to let the process play itself out. I'm not going to try to, comment on things that are beyond my control.
Kerr Putney, Chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it.
Yes.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Business North Carolina magazine, covering the economy, industry, and business of North Carolina each month. September features the NC Higher Education Directory. Subscriptions online at businessnc.com and at the App Store. The shooting of two journalists renews calls for stricter gun controls. President Obama visits New Orleans to mark the 10th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. And the U.S. stock market takes investors on a wild ride. A panel of journalists talks about all of those stories and more in the first hour of the Weekly News Roundup with Diane Rehm in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, the international hour at 11. And when we come back, we'll be talking about the busy week in Raleigh, but still no budgets. Stay with us.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
The recent explosions in Tianjin, sadly, are sort of China's Katrina. It's an obvious symbol of corruption and incompetence.
It's your community. we help you understand it.
The state audit shows that Community Care of North Carolina is both saving the state money and improving patient outcomes.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. This morning, the state budget is 59 days overdue. The legislature is into its, I think, third extension, maybe the third extension? Okay. Allowing it to operate the government until a budget has congealed, and at least one legislator says we're inching closer. But the budget isn't the only thing lawmakers have been working on in what has proven to be a busy week behind the scenes in Raleigh. And here to catch us up on all of this are Tom Bullock and Ben Bradford from WFAE News. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
We are now, as I said, 59 days into the fiscal year and still no final budget. What or who are the stumbling blocks here?
Well, quite a few things, actually. But if you want to break it down into basic camps, Mike, you can point to simple, very strongly held philosophical differences between the Senate and the House. These are the two. The governor has – I mean, Governor McCrory entered his own budget in earlier, but he hasn't really played a part in this yet. But right now, they're really fighting over some very particular things.
Yeah, the governor's budget was more ambitious, I think, even than the House, and the House budget was more ambitious than the Senate. Then the House has found it difficult to make cuts in order to line their budget up with the Senate's lower figures. Is that essentially it?
Actually, the House was higher than the governor's. But I mean, what it boils down to is this: the way the negotiations are happening right now is it's if you think of the inverted pyramid, they've agreed on a big number, $21.735 billion for the state budget. Mm-hmm. Okay, they came to that agreement. It took a long time for them to come to that agreement. They only came to it last week after the second continuing resolution was already in place.
Right, so these are temporary stopgap spending measures just to keep government running.
And then finally they've come down and they said, okay, well, now we've decided how much generally each department or division in the government is going to get. So that's kind of divvying up that big pie into individual slices. And now they say, oh, yeah, we're making huge amounts of progress, which they have made progress. But the reality of it is now comes the real nitty-gritty. And this is where the stuff gets tough because they have to start going through all of the specific details on every program, every bill, every initiative to figure out exact dollar amounts. And that's where things start to disappear from budgets. That's where that's where the real compromise comes from. So they've still got a ways to go.
So the Senate and the House are at odds a little bit. Senator Phil Berger has urged Representative Nelson Dollar to work with us. Is he saying that because Nelson Dollar in the House is not cooperating, or because they got to move that hot potato around so somebody takes the blame, but not me?
Well, there's a certain amount of gamesmanship in that as well, isn't there? You know, you're not getting what you want entirely on the budget, so you publicly call somebody else out. So I think that's part of it as well. There was a very good article in the News and Observer earlier this week that kind of detailed how Representative Dollar is a sort of a line-by-line guy and likes to go slowly, and apparently this has frustrated some people in the Senate and even some people in the House. But I think really it does come down to these major policy differences, and they're the same policy differences that we've seen all year and that, you know, and to some degree the same ones that led to difficulties with the budget last year. If you remember last year, the Senate walked out of a House negotiation on the budget.
Right.
So, you know, we're talking about teacher assistance. The Senate wants to get rid of more teacher assistance after some major cuts last year, and they want to, or 2 years ago, and they want to instead use that money to hire more teachers, reduce classroom sizes. We have major differences over how sales taxes will be distributed, Medicaid, how to do a Medicaid overhaul. So, all these different kinds of things they're trying to get into the same budget.
So now they've passed several continuing resolutions, which allows the government to keep operating while they're working on the final budget details. And if I've done this, if I've understood this correctly, if the budget isn't passed by Tuesday of next week, this will be the fourth most overdue budget in 44 years. Now, in addition to being an inconvenience and a record, how much is this costing taxpayers?
Fortunately, we have a figure for that, $2.1 million if it goes through September 18th, which is when the current third continuing resolution is slated to end. And that money is divvied up by the extra legislative costs, the per diems that lawmakers get, their transportation costs. And, you know, it's a significant amount of money. I mean, we were putting that into context for a story this morning. And what it works out to is it's the average teacher salary for 47 teachers in CMS. And we got that from CMS. The average salary they have, just salary alone, is $44,600. So that's 47 teachers for an entire year. I asked them how many schools that, you know, can you give me a school that where 47 teachers would make up the entire teacher population? They said five elementary schools in the district and one middle school. So to let people wrap their brains around it, it's a significant chunk
of
change.
And the reason it's costing that amount of money is what? Legislator salaries and per diem? Or
the salary
is it
doesn't
something
change.
Else?
It's the per diems. It's keeping extra legislative staff salaries going. It's the simple things, too, like traveling back and forth. I mean, North Carolina officially, although if they keep this up, they're not going to be able to say this much longer, legislators are part-time legislators. Mm-hmm. They all have day jobs, but they've been at this for so long now, you almost wonder how they're getting those other jobs done.
So they're having to haggle on – the Senate has to be willing to come up in what they're willing to spend and the on certain things, and the House has got to be willing to go down on things that they're willing to spend. How are the compromises being reached, and on what are they being reached so far?
Well, that's one of the things I find so interesting. I mean, last week we saw them agree, as Tom mentioned, to this base budget number. And if you remember, the House and Senate were about $500 million apart in spending, which, you know, when you're talking about, you know, a 20-odd billion dollar budget, might not sound like that much, but it's all about how much it grows, because you have certain things that are embedded costs, and then it's about how much is going to expand beyond that. Well, the final number that they agreed to is much closer to the Senate's number than it is to the House number, because they ended up spending, $420 million less than the House wanted. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's kind of interesting right there. It leads to, and then, of course, that number is going to affect those different departments, those different agencies. So right now we're kind of hearing that for teacher salaries, the House wanted to raise them 2%.
And that's for – sorry to correct you, but that's for across-the-board salaries.
Yes, right, exactly. So across-the-board salaries. And you know, it's pretty obvious that that's not going to be in there at this point.
In fact, now we know that's not going to be in there. They've come up – instead of coming up with a salary raise for everybody, it's a $750 one-time bonus.
Yeah, teachers and state employees will receive a $750 bonus. That's instead of the planned 2% across-the-board increases that the House wanted. What does that represent for the average employee?
I actually ran the numbers on that, and it works out to about a 1.7% raise for the average salary for a state worker. Now, of course, that's going to vary depending on where you are in that salary range.
But is that in keeping with the cost of living rise? Has there been a rise in the cost? Of course there has. There always is.
And I don't know the specific numbers on that, Mike, okay, but I can tell you that this is the first one they've had in, even though it's just a one-time bonus, in quite some time.
And as I understand it, they've reached a compromise on something else. Early career teachers, new teachers, would get a pay raise to $35,000. What about teachers who have been on the job for decades?
Well, if you think this sounds familiar from last year, it does, and it is. They still get step increases. They're still in the budgets. There's still what's called a hold harmless clause, which means teachers won't get paid less, but their overall percentage of experienced teacher pay increases is still being negotiated.
And of course, the budget hasn't passed, and so there's still some ifs, ands, or buts about what's going to happen ultimately with funding for education. That leaves the schools all over the state in kind of a state of disarray. Mm-hmm. How is that impacting schools here and elsewhere at the moment?
Uncertainty is a tricky thing when you're trying to plan a major organization, which really all school districts are. If you think about this, let's take the Senate plan. The Senate would like to hire a whole bunch more teachers and shrink class sizes in early grades. Well, but by doing that, they would cut, you know, teacher assistant positions. So the school districts like CMS are still left scratching their heads trying to figure out, well, what are we going to have to do? These continuing resolutions keep the status quo in place, but they don't know if they're supposed to be going out. School districts don't know if they're supposed to be going out, getting ready to hire new teachers. How can you find them at this state of the game? It really just leaves them scratching their head waiting to see.
And as I understand it, there's uncertainty about teacher assistants and having the money to fund those positions. The Senate wants to cut funding for about 1,700 of those people this year and increase spending on teachers to reduce class sizes. Now, to do that, it seems to me you have to hire more teachers to reduce the class size. And at this stage of the game, hiring teachers seems to be not...
I think that's the problem right now that we're hearing from schools. I mean, and if you cut teacher assistants in the middle of the year, then all of a sudden you're letting people go mid-year as you've already had classes running. I mean, this is one of the reasons that granted the fiscal year ends in the summer, but this is one of the reasons that's the case, right? Is that they want to be able to have all this stuff set before one of these major kind of parts of the state budget have to be finished, which is education.
And there's another thing here. I mean, we've heard from school district officials who say, let's imagine for a second that we get all of these new teachers. It's an incredibly expensive gift that we can't afford. And here's why. Even though the state would pay the bulk of those salaries, where do you put them? To reduce class sizes, it's more than just having extra teachers.
More rooms.
You need new schools. You need more classrooms. It's like, do we need to go out and buy a whole bunch of trailers? Do we need to start building new schools? Where is that money going to come from?
One of the things that's up in limbo in many places and I think has been canceled in at least two districts has been driver education. Where does that stand? Because the DMV mandates a certain number of hours of driver education for young people getting their license.
So this is the classic problem with the temporary budget, which is that in the temporary budget, driver's education is not funding. Some districts have continued to fund it for a little while, but as this current one expires, we know that that many of them, our colleague Lisa Wharf just did a story about this. We know that many of them are going to stop funding that in general. Now, the Senate's budget, their initial budget, if that had passed, it would have said, okay, driver's education is no longer a requirement. We're going to raise the number of hours that people need to drive with an adult, that 16-year-olds, people under 18 need to drive with an adult before they can go and take their driver's test. But you no longer need to take this formal driver's education thing. Because that budget hasn't passed, the requirement still exists, but the funding for driver's education no longer exists. So that's sort of this kind of limbo thing for people who want to get their kids who want to get their license.
So there are reports that the final budget will spend more than $100 million less on education than the House wanted and more than $150 million less on health and human services than the House proposed. Where might the final figures actually end up? Do you know?
That is the $21.735 billion question.
Well, and of course, the other part about this is that any of these things can change. What you often see last-minute changes, maybe they've got something that's set. Oh, but now we need to find another $10, $15, $50, $100 million somewhere. So let's go back to this other place where we said it before. So all this is in flux.
And part of the reason, too, it's in flux is there are a lot of programs the House really likes that the Senate really doesn't. I mean, one of them is something I know you've been covering, Ben, which is a solar energy credit, which actually does get an extension, I believe, under the House but not under the Senate.
Yeah, that's right. And the House cuts it to a two-year – and I actually don't remember where the Senate ended up on it, but it is a more drastic cut than that. And that's going to be interesting with the Obama administration just put out this big climate change rule that relies on states expanding their renewable energy. So that's going to be a very interesting question.
Why is the Senate against that? Is it because they don't want the loss of revenue that would be created by tax credits?
I think an easier way to say it is they see the tax credits as a form of corporate welfare in essence, and they say that solar energy is far too expensive. It's not worth the tax credit, and that they're getting a head start on traditional sources of energy like oil and coal.
Yeah, the argument tends to be that solar has grown so much that North Carolina is now often rated the second most solar state, and that this has all happened very quickly. All right, now it's a viable industry. We don't need to prop it up anymore. That tends to be the argument that you hear from the Senate.
Aren't we propping up the oil industry still?
That would be a good question for the Senate.
In addition to opening additional charter schools this year, including two online charters, the state Supreme Court has given the go-ahead to vouchers for private schools. Are they funded in this budget? And if so, how will they be handed out?
So vouchers have been funded, there's been talk of the Supreme Court decision, which happened last month, is interesting. They, as you said, they certified that the state can offer this voucher program. That's after a superior court had struck it down as unconstitutional. Both House and Senate have wanted to raise the amount for it, and I think that with that decision, it'll be really interesting to see if they then decide to go ahead with it now that they know that they can run this program.
And there have been changes to the state's unemployment benefits that passed the first two required votes in the Senate. That bill would raise the number of employers that a person receiving benefits have to contact each week. Anything else?
Well, there's a whole bunch of technical changes in there that probably aren't worth getting into so much. But you have to remember that the state really changed how it offers unemployment benefits in general a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. So it cut the maximum amount of benefits, the number of weeks, and really, you know, overhauled this program. They're dealing with a massive deficit for it. So as they've been climbing out of it, this latest change made some technical corrections to kind of this big overhaul. But I think that the big thing that got the most attention and drew the most heat was that people on unemployment benefits, if they want to stay on them, have to reach out to significantly more employers. And it makes North Carolina one of the states with one of the strictest requirements in terms of that.
Lawmakers continue to talk about how to overhaul the state's Medicaid program, and the state auditor recently released a report on community care of North Carolina, which coordinates services for about 80% of the state's Medicaid recipients. Was it a good report? How might that impact fixing the system?
Well, what it found is that Medicaid, under the program that you're talking about, when you give incentives to providers, to hospitals, doctors, pharmacists, and the like, you can control costs. It found that it is actually basically returning a 3-to-1 ratio. Mm-hmm. For every dollar that's put into this, you get $3 back. It's working, but you know, the trick is the Senate doesn't want it that way. They want them to go basically to insurance companies, and this is all still supposed to be hashed out before everything is over.
Wow. And don't delete your Uber app quite yet, because they're working on that too, correct?
I believe that passed.
That passed.
Yeah.
It passed?
That passed. That is a done deal.
So they'll be regulating Uber, Lyft, and Sidecar. Not unlike the way they do taxi cabs,
actually completely differently.
Okay.
Yep, it's a whole lot easier. You don't have to register in the same way. So taxi cab companies are going to be upset by that.
Tom Bullock, Ben Bradford from WFAE News. Thanks for the update.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.